Hello, everybody. Welcome and thank you for coming. My name is Reem Ramawi, and I'm the president of Students for Justice in Palestine here at UNO. Tonight, I would like to introduce David Sheen, a Canadian-Israeli independent journalist and filmmaker. Sheen began blogging when he first moved to Israel in 1999 and has written for many publications, including Al Jazeera, Huffington Post, and The Daily Beast. He has spoken throughout the U.S., Canada, and Europe, and is currently writing a book about African immigrants to Israel and the struggles that they face. Let's all give a warm New Orleans welcome to David Sheen.
Thank you so much for coming. People who weren't able to come out tonight will be able to see this material. And, of course, I'm also going to be adding URLs so that when you see some of this stuff, you may find it hard to believe. You'll be able to go onto the internet afterwards and look this stuff up and verify. With the title that I've chosen, The Bullet, the Ballot, and the Boycott, people generally assume that I'm going to be speaking about boycotting Israel. But in fact, I'm not going to be speaking about boycotting Israel. I'm going to be speaking about Israel boycotting. Because I contend that Israel actually boycotts its own non-Jewish citizens in many facets of life. Let's talk about what is a boycott, first of all. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, we're talking about a withdrawal from social or commercial interaction or cooperation with a group. And I'd say that defines what we see in Israel. Now, we think of Israel, at least in the public imagination, as this place. We think of the kibbutzim, these socialist communes, this back-to-the-land movement where people were forming agrarian collectives and farming the earth. And it was all those things, all for one, one for all, but only if you were Jewish. And if you were a Palestinian person living in the land and you also held socialist ideals and you also wanted to be part of this movement and you applied to join one of these agrarian communes, you were rejected outright and told, no, we only accept Jews. We boycott non-Jews. That's the kibbutz. We move to villages and we see that the Israeli government boycotts non-Jewish Palestinian towns and villages, and it does not give the same kinds of funding that it does to Jewish towns and villages. So because of this, these towns can't expand. Clearly the population expands, people bring another generation into the world, and you need to build more houses, but the government doesn't allow these towns to expand. And so one family at least, the Ka'adan family, Palestinian citizens of Israel, they said, well, I mean, Israel is ostensibly a democracy, so why can't we just buy a house in the next town over, or in the next village? And so they did this. They applied for a permit to build a house in the next village. They were told, no, we only allow Jewish people to buy land and to build houses here. We boycott non-Jews. This seemed to be an obvious case of discrimination. So the Ka'adan family took it to the court system and it actually went all the way up to the Supreme Court. In the Supreme Court, the court asked the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, to respond to these charges of racism because in Israel, most of the land is actually either owned by the government or by quasi-state organizations like the Jewish National Fund. And so this is what the JNF had to say in response to these charges. It said, "The JNF is not a public body that works for the benefit of all citizens of the state. The loyalty of the JNF is given to the Jewish people, and only to them is the JNF obligated. The JNF does not have a duty to practice equality towards all citizens of the state." With this kind of response, the Supreme Court did find in favor of the Ka'adan family, said this is base discrimination, and they should be allowed to purchase land and to build a house in that village. That's good. But unfortunately, as so often happens with the Supreme Court, they lay down the law and they launder the worst excesses of the Knesset, and then the Knesset just comes up with another way to get around this new ruling. In fact, they passed a new law that they ceremoniously dubbed the Ka'adan Loophole Law. So they did. They got around the law just saying, well, from now on, towns and villages across the country can refuse admittance, can restrict admission to Jews only. Well, as long as you don't say it's for racial reasons, as long as you say you don't fit the cultural profile, but you don't even have to explain what that is. You don't have to justify it. As long as you just use this neutral language, towns and villages can continue to boycott non-Jewish people, people of color, queer people, whoever doesn't fit your idea of a cultural profile. But most often it affects Palestinian citizens of Israel. So that's kibbutzim, villages, and it happens in cities as well. And we have the town of Upper Nazareth in the north of the country, and this is the mayor, Shimon Gafso. In Upper Nazareth, similar to the rest of the country, we're talking about maybe 80%, 75-80% Jewish population, about 20-25% Palestinian citizens of Israel. Clearly, those Palestinian citizens of Israel want their children to learn Arabic. They want them to grow up speaking Arabic. It's their mother tongue. They want to send them to an Arab language school. But the mayor refuses to allow the establishment of any Arabic language school in his town. And he justifies this in an op-ed piece he writes in Haaretz newspaper. He says, "Upper Nazareth is a Jewish city. I am a proud offshoot of a glorious dynasty of racists." When he comes up for re-election, he actually campaigns on this basis. So he puts out posters proclaiming pride in this, hoping that other racists will vote for him on the basis of these policies. He writes there, "No more sticking to the law that allows any citizen to live wherever they want to." So there's no shame around it. There's no need to couch this in euphemisms. It's just straight up racism. And it passes. It's acceptable in society. So we're talking about how non-Jewish people are boycotted in Israel on the basis of housing, kibbutzim, villages, towns, cities, new developments. So let's say you want to buy a house from a developer. You see this pamphlet or this brochure, and you're enticed by it. Looks attractive. And sure enough, you go through the 3D renderings and the photographs that they've included, and that's appealing to you, and you also want to buy a house in this new development. So sure enough, you call up the developer, and you want to make an appointment to see one of these apartments. But when you call, they hear that you have an Arabic accent. And so they say, "Aval anachnu lo mochrim la'aravim, okay? But we do not sell to Arabs, okay?" And of course, you call 5 minutes later, or you get your Jewish friend to call up 5 minutes later, and he has a Hebrew accent, and he has a Hebrew name, and he lives in a Jewish village. And so then, of course, it's, "Oh, sure, no problem, come on down and get it." And of course, it's not that companies that do this then face some kind of censure. It's not that they're punished in any way. We continue as if it's all good. And so these developers of Givat Ha'oranim, here they are meeting, getting a hug from the Minister of Housing at that time, Uri Ariel. It shouldn't shock anyone considering the previous public statements of Uri Ariel. He's gone on record as saying, "We must encourage Arabs to willingly leave, both from the cities and from the state." So this is how in Israel Palestinian people are boycotted on housing. Let's move to the labor market. So you can be walking down the street in Israel and you can see a sign like this. It's altogether common. Of course, I'll translate it into English for your benefit. "Jewish workers, plaster, paint, renovations." If we were looking for a Torah scribe, I could understand why you would advertise the employee's Jewishness. But for plastering and painting, I don't think that there's any reason why you would necessarily need to seek out a Jewish worker. Of course, the idea here is they're trying to appeal to fellow racists, saying, if you don't want to spend a penny, to put a penny in a Palestinian pocket, then hire us, because we have only Jewish workers, and so you can ensure that every dime will only go to support Jewish families. This is the idea. And this is common in the country. And until a couple of years ago, you could go through the yellow pages, right? Do they even still have that in the analog era? But you recall from back in the day, yellow pages, they would use words like these, avodat ivrit, and of course translate it Jewish labor. It's kind of a euphemism, a coded language. The meaning is, we only hire Jews. So pay for our goods and services, and you can be sure that your money won't go to support Palestinian people. Of course, now we're in the internet era, so we have websites that collect all this information and tabulate it so that you can ensure that your racist dollars only go towards fellow Jews. And of course, we also have citizens' initiatives. So this is a photograph of the Machane Yehuda market. This is the largest market in Jerusalem. Hustling and bustling and lots of activity. And so what we have is a group of people going from, if you can imagine this, from stall to stall and from store to store. And in every one, they ask, excuse me, do you have any Arabs working here? Do you have any Africans working here? Or are there only Jews in your employ? And once they verify who's working there, then they jot it down and they create a chart and they create an illustration. And they publish this so that you will know which stores only hire Jews and which stores have non-Jewish workers, so you can do all your shopping and ensure that it only goes towards people of your own ethnic group. I'm sad to say that it's just becoming more and more common to see this kind of activity. For example, this young man wrote on his Facebook page a while back, "The Arab sons of bitches, it's our duty to boycott every Arab business or product. I boycotted those shits even before." Nothing out of the ordinary about this particular young man, except that he happens to be the son of the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. So we see how the apple falls not far from the tree. So we've talked about housing, and we've talked about labor, how Palestinian people are boycotted. Now we'll talk about recreation. So I don't need to tell you, down here in Louisiana, in the Middle East, it gets hot. And in the summer especially, you want to go out, you want to take a dip in a pool. But if you live in one of those Palestinian villages and towns, you're being boycotted by the government, and so you don't get the same kind of funding, and so you don't have the money to build a public pool for the residents of your town. So comes the summer, and you want to take your kids out, something to do, and you realize that, okay, it's a small country, so again, why shouldn't I be able to go over to the next town in one of these Jewish villages? Every one of these Jewish villages has public pools. You know, it's only 10-15 minute drive to the next town. So you get in the car, or you call them up, and you ask them, you know, can we come and visit your pool? You know, we're happy to pay for the privilege. And they say, no, we only allow people from our own village to swim in the pool. And you call up village after village, and you get the same answer every time. Of course, 5 minutes later, your Jewish colleague calls them up, and they hear his accent, and they say, sure, no problem, we're open. Alan wasalan, you know. And this is how it goes. Admittedly, at least one of these places will allow Palestinian people to come swim, but then they'll charge them twice the amount for the privilege to do so. It also extends to, you know, theme parks. Like, I guess you'd have Six Flags here in the U.S. So people, again, work hard all week, want to take their kids out on the weekend and, you know, get in the car and drive out there to Superland or whatever they call the Israeli version of Six Flags. And you get there, and at the gate, you're told, oh, no, we don't allow Palestinian people in today. It's Jews only, you know. But, you know, don't be offended, because there's other days of the week that are Palestinian only. So that's somehow supposed to compensate for that. So this is how, even in recreational facilities, Palestinian people are boycotted. Okay, we talked about housing, we talked about labor, we talked about recreation, and it extends also to political representation. Palestinian people's political representatives are boycotted. So here, this is a photograph that was published in an Israeli newspaper of a debate between political party leaders. So I know that here in the United States, you're still working with the two-party system. My condolences. With all of Israel's problems, and there's no small amount, I actually prefer this model where you have lots and lots of parties running in the election, so you have a diversity of views. And when it comes down to facing off in a candidate's debate, there's lots of people, there's lots of participants, rather. And so this is a photograph of one of these televised debates in the last election cycle, right? But the problem is, this isn't the original photograph, okay? This is what was published in the newspaper, but this is the original photograph. Notice that in the original, there's another person in the photograph. That's Ayman Odeh, but the reason that the paper cut him out is because he is a Palestinian citizen of Israel, and he represents the Palestinian party in the Israeli Knesset. And so, to them, he's not even a legitimate candidate. He's not even an option. We just, like, cut him out altogether, you know. Now, we go through the list, and we see how the Israeli politicians from the other parties dismiss them outright and treat them with disrespect. So Yair Lapid, the so-called centrist, he so despises Hanin Zoabi, one of the Palestinian members of the Knesset, that when he speaks of the joint Arab list, when he speaks of the Palestinian members of the Knesset, he can't stand to even call them out by name. He says, I would never work with any of the Zoabis. And to him, they're all Zoabis. You know, this is essentially the equivalent. I don't know if you can see it all the way back there. I photoshopped her face on too. So, but this is, I mean, this is basically the equivalent of a white congressperson or congressional representative calling all the African American representatives in the Congress, oh, I would never work with any of those Leroys or something like that. It's completely racist, but you know, this passes in Israel. This is considered, it's all good. When these members of the Knesset want to, you know, have meetings with foreign diplomats who come to the country, that's their job, to have political meetings. And so the Speaker of the Knesset, Yuli Edelstein, forbids them from doing so, forbids these Palestinian members of Knesset from meeting with foreign diplomats unless there's a member of the government sitting in on their meetings, actually spying on their meetings and reporting back to the government. Because it's like they don't even have any real political, they're not even allowed to conduct legitimate political activity, you know? So this is how they are just basically a fig leaf for Israel's democracy. Of course, Stav Shafir, the so-called social justice leader who's now in the Knesset, she is so afraid that anyone will see her talking to a Palestinian member of the Knesset. You know, she doesn't want to be associated with them. Heaven forbid, you know, that she lose the racist vote. And so she apparently won't even say hello to them. You know, she'll just like walk down the hall and like act as if they're air, as if they don't even exist. She won't even nod and acknowledge their existence. You know, they're not even humans in the same sphere as her. But, I mean, when we go to the government, we see that, of course, it can get much worse than that. The deputy interior minister, in the Knesset itself, during a debate, he says to the Palestinian members of the Knesset, return your identity card. We are doing you people a favor by even allowing you to be seated here. Straight up. Of course, the former foreign minister of the country until just recently, Avigdor Lieberman, he takes it to the next level. The heads of the Nazi regime were executed. I hope this will be the fate of the Arab members of the Knesset. This is what we're up against. This is how Palestinian people's representatives, political representatives, are boycotted. This is how Palestinian people are boycotted by the Israeli state and by increasingly large numbers of the Israeli population. Notice that in this entire discussion, I have not once mentioned the Nakba. I have not once mentioned the Naqsa. I have not once mentioned the West Bank. I have not once mentioned Gaza. I have not once mentioned all the houses that were destroyed. I have not once mentioned 550 youth killed last summer. I have only been talking about what's happening inside pre-1967 Israel. Because there's this discourse, and maybe you've heard it here on campus or elsewhere, of liberal Zionists. And when the idea of boycotting Israel comes up, you know, then they're quick to jump in and say, wait a minute, that's not fair. It's not fair to boycott Israel because if you're opposed to what Israel's doing in the territories, then you should boycott the territories. You should boycott the settlements. You should boycott goods and services that come out of the settlements. But don't boycott Israel. That's a separate entity altogether. Fine, in the West Bank, that's non-democratic Israel. But in the rest of the country, that's democratic Israel. Those are two separate entities. Now, of course, it's completely ridiculous. This is an artificial separation that has no basis in reality. It's one governing structure. It's one banking system. It's one army. You know, it's one system of oppression that manifests differently in two separate areas, but it's the same system. It's the same people responsible for it.